just to give ourselves a general idea of how the Holocaust affected the Sephardic communities. As I've been reading and talking to friends, the story is amazing. And it's amazing also how this story is practically not known. Well, let me just go in case we... In 1935, as the Germans, the Nazis, were developing laws, there were these famous Nuremberg laws. They were racial laws with the idea of talking about the people that were the best race, the highest race that there was, and anybody who didn't belong to that race, so they were lower class of individuals. Of course, the Jews were classified as these people that didn't belong to the race of the Aryan race. And as the Holocaust began, and the Germans began to persecute the Jews all over Europe, in 1941 they encountered a problem. As they entered into the country of Holland, there was there a different group of people. All of a sudden, these people are not the same people as the Jews that they knew. These Jews had a bigger skull. So could you define these Jews as being part of the other Jews? Many stories went into research. Many people went into research on these matters, trying to decide whether these people were Jews. The same problem they encountered in France, where about 50,000 Jews, some from the 250,000 Jews that were in France, some 50,000 were of Sephardic origin. Some great professors, Nazis amongst them, decided that the Sephardic Jews weren't really Jews, and they really belonged to some different group of people that had developed before the Israelites had come into the land of Israel. As this discussion was taken up to the higher people in power and amongst the Nazis, they decided, we can't do this. We can't differentiate amongst one group of people and another. We're going to have all types of claims. We can't do this. They decided to include the Sephardic Jews amongst the people that were going to be persecuted. And so this is how amazing the story is. And just to give us an idea of some of the people that will sound, some of the names that will sound familiar to us, some of the Jews that we have in record that were taken to concentration camps, there are names like Melamed, Adut, Elmale, Farhi, Basi, Beraka, Alfandri, Baruch, Hassan. These are common names that we know here in our communities. And you have to remember that Sephardic communities were always very, very together, very united. The contact amongst the Sephardic communities was very strong. And so we see that, unfortunately, it came to pass that Sephardic communities were greatly affected by this. When the Germans came into Greece in 1941, one of the most important Sephardic communities there at the time was the community of Salonika. Among the historians, they talk about this community as the Jerusalem of the Balkans. if you remember your history, in 1492, the Jews were expelled from Spain. The Ottoman Empire in the area of the Middle East and the Balkans was developing. The Sultan told the Jews, come over to my land and take it over. I know that you're people of good. My land will be blessed. And so it was that many, many Jews came over to the Balkans, to the Middle East, and occupied it, and developed beautiful communities. One of these communities was the community of Salonika. In Salonika, at the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, it is said that it was basically a port. No ship could come into Salonika on Shabbat. It was impossible. There was nobody there to take care of the ship that was coming in. The people, if you read the history, it sounds as vibrant as God bless this community. People strolling in Shabbat by the hundreds. People singing Bakashot. The Hazanim, they know the Makamim. 30 Makamim at a time. And this beautiful community finds itself engulfed in the middle of this Nazi madness. I'm just going to be short, but the historians, and today they tell us Salonika is practically a city where Jewish life is hardly seen today. At the turn of the 20th century, the percentage of Jews in the community was up to 90%. Today, there's about the number is about 1,000 Jews in the city of Salonika. And many wonder, how could it be? What happened? The explanations are many. They say, well, for the Sephardim, it was much more difficult to grasp the hatred of these people. We didn't live in a land where we knew hatred. We lived in a land that we made friends. We had businesses. We were people of good. People don't do this type of harm. And so when the Nazis came, it was incomprehensible that this evil would ever come. And so the people trusted and trusted again. The terrible story is told in another small community, the community of Janina, a community of about 2,000 people. This community was also occupied by the Germans in 1941. In 1943, the rumors had come to Janina that all of the Jews of Salonika had been deported. And you could imagine how shocking it was to these communities, to these people, the people of Janina, a small community of 2,000, to hear that the biggest community right next to them had disappeared. The community that was the glory, the community that they all looked up to, the biggest rabbis, the great Hachamim that were in town, they all disappeared. And so they had the president and the vice president of the community discuss what would they do should they run away. There was a man by the name of Kabili. He was the vice president of the community. And he said, you know what? In Salonika, unfortunately, many people did not observe the laws. They did not observe the Shabbat. In Janina, everybody observes Shabbat. Nothing will happen to us. And so it was that every time that the Germans took over a city, they looked for the person that was the weakest and they made him the leader of the community, or the person that they would see fit for him to collaborate with them. And that person would slowly help the Nazis, with intention or without intention, to strip the people from their property, their money, their houses, eventually to be forced with almost nothing to be taken into trains and to be transported, to be deported. Kabili, the last day, as they've been put into trucks, turns to the president of the community and he says, I'm guilty. I was fooled. and it was a complete outrage. But he believed that because of the observance of the community, they would not be harmed. They kept the Shabbat. In a different story, there was a community in Volos, a small city. The community of Jews numbered about 800, 900 people. And they had heard what had happened in Salonika, and they had heard what was happening in Yanina, and they were afraid if it was going to happen to them too. And so it was that the Hassam of Moshe Pesach was called over by the Nazis, the Gestapo, brought over to their office that they were occupying in the city of Volos, and asked to supply them with the list of Jews, as they did in every other town. We need the list of the Jews that live in Volos. The rabbi said, it will take me a few days, but I'll get you the list. The rabbi went back, hesitated, and after the 3 days that they had asked him to provide him the list, the rabbi came and said, I'm sorry, I wasn't able to put it together. It's a lot of people and it's a lot of work. You got to give me more time. And the Hacham was hesitant. The rabbi was very good friends with the priest of the town. And right after he left the Nazi, the Gestapo, he went and he spoke to him. And the priest told the rabbi, you know what they want to do. This is the process of Salonika, and this is the process of the other cities. Rabbi, tell your people to leave. Tell your people to go. The rabbi, that afternoon, gathered the kehillah together, the community together, and told everybody, everybody fend for yourselves. Get out of the city. Go into the mountains. Don't come back here. They're going to take us away. They're going to kill us. And so it was that one of the few communities that we can say that its highest number survived was the small community of Volos. Only a number of about 100 of them came back because they couldn't stand living in the mountains. As they came back, the Nazis transported them and then deported them to Auschwitz. This is the story of the Sephardim that unfortunately it's not being told. We have to hear the story. This, I just told you a little bit of a sea of stories that we know, that we can recover now, that we'll be beginning to find out. The Sephardic communities in the Holocaust approached the Holocaust in a very different manner. They approach life in a very different manner. It's the culture that teaches us to be happy, to live a great life. And when there is crisis, we approach it in a different way. I want to invite now Estrella Levy to tell us her story. She came from the city of Rhodes. To tell us her story, please.
Books. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
No?
Not working.
It's an electrical engineer. Good evening. Can you hear me? Okay. My name is Stella Levy, and I am from the island of Rhodes in Greece. But I am going to tell you before telling my story what the political condition of the island was when I was born. It was Italian, it wasn't Greek. Before that, it was Turkish under the Ottoman Empire. So therefore the island changes hands. The Italians were very good for us. They brought I would say, civilization, even though the Ottomans were good too, but in a different way. The Italians brought what we thought it was the Western world culture. And for a long time, in fact, during my childhood, which was a very happy one, it did not matter what whether you had money or you did not have money. Everybody, we lived in a Juderia. The Juderia is a type of, not really ghetto, but it's a district where all the Jews live, because that's where the synagogues are. And in fact, the few Jews who left the Juderia and went out to live amongst the Gentiles, they had to come all the way to the Juderia to live for Shabbat, and then eventually some of them did not come anymore. But the people from in the Jewish district always lived there, because it was the proximity of the synagogues. It was very important for them. Anyway, as I said, the Italians were, during their first period in the island, I am a little nervous, so you have to forgive me. I'm not a public speaker, so. The first few years, it was a good years. In fact, one of the governors of the island, an Italian gentleman, gave the permit to build a rabbinical college, which was really the pride of our city, of our Jews. And many students came from all over, from Egypt, from Lebanon, from Syria. They came to study and to become rabbis, shochets, and other things. But then in 1938, Mussolini had decreed the racial laws. By then I was going to Italian schools. Before that, I did go for 5 years elementary classes at the Talmud Torah, the Jewish school in the district where we lived, which we called Juderia. My sisters had gone before that. They had gone to the Alliance Israélite Française, which were also very good schools that were brought in by the Rothschild friends, the Rothschild brothers from Paris. In 1938, it was the biggest insult to me personally when the decree was that we couldn't attend the school, the Italian schools anymore. So my life was interrupted. But nonetheless, things weren't as bad as we thought they would be with all the restrictions. But some of the people had to leave the island because they came from Turkey and did not have Italian citizenship. So they had to leave. And when they left, we were crying, and they were crying because they were leaving, but little did they know that they were saved and we ended up in Auschwitz. They went to Tangier, they went to Africa, to other places, and some of them went back to Turkey, because it was absolutely impossible to get to Palestine, even though they all wanted to go there. Then the war broke up, and the Italians were allied with the Germans. The Sephardim, very proud people, very proud. We always, I'm going to give you a little bit of what was the life in the Juderia. Every little bit of a holiday, every festivity was always a big deal. Shabbat, Friday afternoon, everything, not only the port in Salonique, which was true, it was closed, because all the people who did work in the port were Jews. But for us in Rhodes, also a port, but the whole town closed, because the Italians and the Greeks couldn't do any businesses if we were not open. So therefore Shabbat came, it was absolutely, I cannot tell you what happened on Yom Kippur and the other holidays. There was nobody in the streets. Only the Jews in the, you know, walking around the Judea, and that was it. Whereas for Purim, for instance, everybody came into the Judea because it was a big holiday. Big things, music, dances, right in the square. And in fact, some Italians would come even for Pesach, so amazed that we would start cleaning even the streets and whitewash the walls outside on the outside of the houses and all this. And they said, "What are these people doing? I mean, it's crazy like that." And it's always. I cannot, and we lived one on top of the other because all the houses are together. It was a, I don't know if any of you had visited Rhodes, right? It's, they were built by the Venetians, and before the Venetians, I must tell you that the Jews went to live in Rhodes. There were a settlement of Jews in Rhodes at the time, of course at the time of Herod, because he did send money for the Jews in Rhodes, so we know that that's history. And but before that, also, when the Phoenicians were traveling and they left a little settlement of Jews in Rhodes, 2,200 years ago, 200 years before Christ, and before the era. Anyway, so. Religiously, they were all, I would say, religious people. And my father was a chazan in a small, he did that volunteer, in a small synagogue, because the people that went to that little synagogue did not have the money to spend for the big synagogue, so therefore they did not have a chazan, so my father had to go to that synagogue. Whereas my mother and all the others went to the big synagogue. And but I must say that I was very proud. First of all, because he had a beautiful voice. And second of all, I still would say nobody ever sang the Seder like him, or the Shir HaShirim like him. Nobody. And because I must say that I am very proud of that. And unfortunately, there were no tapes or cassettes at the time to register all this. And very innocently, we all accepted the things that were coming. We did not know much of what was happening outside, even though we knew that they were taking the Jews from Poland, from Germany, but we never thought that they would come all the way to the island of Rhodes. An island that was so peaceful, so beautiful, so it was really a vacation island. It wasn't anything else. And of course, the Italians were not taking the Jews to the camps, because Mussolini himself had said to Hitler, and that also is recorded historically, that if I were to take the Jews, my own citizens, my own Jews, to camps, I would take them to camps in Italy and not to Germany. So therefore, until 1943, we were not touched at all by the Germans. The Italians were there with the racial laws. Of course, there were many restrictions, and of course, also rationing, like everywhere else. But in general, it was, I would say, and we also had air raids and few bombs and so forth, but in general it was okay. It wasn't as bad as other places. And as I said, we were continuing, instead of having five or six synagogues, we only had two synagogues. But everybody, all the people from the Judea went to the synagogues and on Shabbat and we did the same things with all the restrictions. But then in 1943, September, the Italians surrendered to the Allies. That's the history of things of the war. By surrendering to the Allies, they became the enemy of the Germans. So the Germans occupied the island of Rhodes and the 12 islands, the Dodecanese. But there were no Jews in the other islands, only in the island of Kos. So that was 1943. Until 1944, they did not do anything. There was only the Wehrmacht, German soldiers, but we were left to be the same way that we lived before under the Italians. Again, we heard, but we did not really hear of Salonique or of Yanina or of Volos or of any other places. But of course, we couldn't go to the mountains because they would have gotten us. In an island, you are isolated completely, and we couldn't hide any place. Also, because the Greeks were not as friendly as probably the Aniotis or the ones from Volos, as friendly it was. The Turks were friendlier. We always were much friendlier with the Muslims, with the Turks, than with the Greeks. In fact, we had few little events during my lifetime, whereby we would go on Pesach for a picnic or so into a beautiful park, a little bit outside the city. But our mothers would always say, you know, you go with other men, with you, chaperones, because otherwise they would stone you. The Greeks would throw stones and say that we killed a little Greek child and so forth, and we used the blood to put it in the mattress. The usual libel. And after that, in the, then 1944, June, the end of June 1944, we had our, the SS came from Athens, three SS officers with an interpreter. The interpreter was a Greek Jew who, parenthesis, was killed, tried and killed afterwards, after the war, because he gave the names of many, many people, not only from Rhodes and from Salonika and other places. So he was tried by the Greeks, by the Jews and the Greeks, after the war, and he was shot. Yes. And it's amazing because he carries a name that is very, very famous and has a big bank in Israel, Recanati. They were two brothers. And one remained in Germany, did not want to come back to Greece, knowing that of the fate that was waiting for him. In June 1944, as I said, I forgot another event. I am going back the first day of Pesach 1944. There was a big air raid, and the English and Americans bombed the port of Rhodes. The Juderia is next to the port like that. There are the walls, and there is the Juderia, there is the port. Instead of hitting a little orphan ship that was at the pier, all the bombs fell on the Jewish district. 30 Jews died under the bombs. If you go to the island now and you see the Juderia is completely destroyed because of the bombs, nothing else, because of that air raid of Pesach 1944. It was the beginning of the end. We fled immediately into the Greek, into the villages, Greek or non-Greek, but we did not want to stay in the city anymore for fear. And in June 1944, when the SS came from Athens, and we heard there was an announcement, loudspeakers, and then flyers all over. All the Jews, men over 14, should present themselves tomorrow morning with their identity cards. My father had diabetes, and we lived already in the village about an hour away from Rhodes. So I told him that I would go with his identity card, because we thought that they are going to, well, those were the rumors. What are they going to do with us here? They are going to put us maybe in a camp here in Rhodes, and maybe the young people will go to work. So therefore, my father was not in a condition to go to work. They wouldn't need him. So I took his identity card. I went and present myself, and this is when I met the Jew Recanati from Athens, because I did not speak German, and the German almost wanted to kill me when he saw a young woman entering the it was the building of the Air Force, the Italian Air Force, that's where they had gathered us there, and all the men and the young men and the other men were there. And he said to me, Mr. Recanati, well, go back home. But I did not want to go back home. I stayed outside with all the other women and waiting what's going to happen. And the president of the community had given already the list of the whole thing, but not because he wanted to cooperate with the Germans. There was no other way, no other way. Some of the nuns and the priests, the nuns that were my teachers, because I used to go to the Italian school, that's where the nuns were the teachers there, they begged for to save the children. The Germans, the SS said, no, 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 everybody has to go. And 2 days later, three ships came to the port. And everybody, take everything with you, everything that you can carry, but mainly all the jewelry that you have. And so we did, because maybe we are going to exchange it, you know, we'll buy food with that or whatever. I say innocent and ignorant. We were absolutely ignorant, because we did not want to face reality, to really get to know what was happening in the rest of the world, the rest of Europe. What were the Germans doing? And when the ship came from Athens, the British knew, because the partisans, Greek partisans, had told the British that there are three empty ships going to pick up the Jews from Rhodes. They could have bombed them, right? Nothing. They let them come in, and we got in like little lambs. And I'm not going to tell you the horrors of that trip. We had 7 days on that boat, with no food, practically no water. Everybody was sick. People already started to die, the elderly especially. Until we got to Piraeus, and that now I am going to make it a little short, because I know I am dragging too much. Excuse me. It was horrible, horrible. Nobody, there are no words that can describe the horror of that voyage. So difficult, so inhumane, so cruel, so hateful. Then we arrived in Greece. The SS had, I think they took pleasure in beating people, because you could see from their faces that they had to take every little bit of chance to start beating anyone who doesn't run, you know, who doesn't get into the throng quickly or so forth. Like my father, we had to take him and bring him, you know, pull him and put him in the throng to take us to a prison outside Piraeus, the port of Greece, where we stayed there for 3 days. And then the other voyage, horrible voyage that came, was 15 days in the train, 80 people in one cattle car with one little window, with no water. We had to do everything in that same car. And I stood practically for 14 days on my feet, but holding on the window, the only window in the car, because there was no room for me to sit, because my father, mother, and the husband, my other sister, who was older than I, 3 years older. And but if you ask me who else was there, I started to completely detach myself to what was happening around me, because it was too horrible, too humiliating, too inhuman. In fact, I would say subhuman, because I think the cattle that were in originally in those cars were probably treated better than we were. What did they think we that we were? Rabbi Nissim said before of the difference of the races, that we belong to another race. No, they thought we were subhuman, not human race, subhuman. Because the animals, you treat them better. And I still today, I cannot understand that kind of hatred, because it was a very organized kind of everything was so done, if you know, everything was so, everything written when we arrived in Auschwitz, the names. When we arrived in Auschwitz, then it was in between. We stopped in Czechoslovakia, and the International Red Cross, what did they give us? They gave us something, but I don't even remember what it was. Something, some kind of food or whatever. Now, they knew what was happening. They knew. People who already had died in the cars, in the train, and we took them out. The men did take out at least, there were 20 people that died in amongst them an uncle of mine, a man of great wealth and a lot of dignity, and he had to go and be buried in a common grave in Czechoslovakia, someplace. And then we left Athens August 2, the 2nd of August 1944. We arrived in Auschwitz-Birkenau the 16th of August 1944. And we are all listed there, the name, the father and the mother, because later on when I had to go and get claim money from Germany, I wrote to Frankfurt and they sent me the whole curriculum, everything about me, you know, my number, everything. So everything was so very well organized. And usually the Schreibers, the ones who write the things, were Jews that were employed by the Germans. And they had good jobs because they spoke German. German Jews, also the Polish Jews, because they were they spoke Yiddish, so therefore they could understand. When we arrived in Auschwitz, it, aside of the things that you already know, the shaven completely naked in front of everyone, the men coming and tattooing you and telling you to go into the shower, It was like herds of animals like that. I go into the showers, a big building, we don't know what would have happened, but we did not even know then that there was gas anyplace else in the other showers. We were separated, men and women, immediately, you know, at the when we arrived at the train station, at the ramp there. And then the elderly and women with children. So the Salonique people who were there already had come into the trains to take everything that we had. They took them into a big building which was called Canada. And that's where all the things that the Jews brought in, they would put them in that building and then sort them, and the better stuff would be sent to Germany. And then, you know, the rags, the schwarzes, would be for us to dress, you know, for us to be clothed. But the good things already had gone to Germany. So the Salonicles, those are the people from Salonica, would tell us in Ladino immediately, knowing that this train was coming from Athens, they knew that there were Sephardim, they would say, leave the children to the elderly women. Leave the children to the elderly people. We couldn't understand. So a cousin of mine had married during the war and had a little boy, Pepo Junio, 2 years old. She did not want to give the child to the mother. She was only 24. And like that, many others. They all went to the gas chambers directly with their children. We did not know that until 3 weeks later. And that's when the other inmates, French and Belgian women, since we spoke French and we did not speak any German, the big shock was that the Ashkenazim did not accept us as Jews. You don't speak Yiddish, you are not Jewish. For days we had, and beating us, where do you come from? We said, we are Italians. Ooh, Italian macaroni, bagoglio, spitting on us. You are not Jewish. So finally we started to decide, what shall we do to tell these people that we are Jewish? So I remember a lady, you know, for me, a 30-year-old lady was already an elderly woman. And she said, let's tell them a prayer in Hebrew. I mean, they will know that we are Jewish. And so she said, because on Friday, those same Ashkenaz, especially the Polish Jews, they were really some, they were also couples there. They were terrible, terrible. Some of them were very cruel, just as cruel as the Germans. Well, it's true, it's very true. One of them, Magda, we looked for her after the war when we were liberated by the Americans. We looked everywhere for Magda. We called everywhere. Believe me, that we would have killed her. She was an animal. But she was also ignorant. I mean, there was nothing cultivated culture about the girl. I mean, you could see, and then we understand, you know, one of the Polish women would say, a couple, she would say, she spoke a little French, and she would say, you know how many years we are here, you know, we already had become like them, you know, like the Germans. And they were there since 1940. Some of them were there since 1940. Yeah. And that's why they got to have positions of the couples. The Germans came into the camp only to count when the counting was already all done. Then they would go. But it was a Jewish woman who was the couple, Lager Älteste, the couple of the Lager, of 24,000 girls in one camp. Lager B in Auschwitz. Lager C, and Frank went to Lager C, which was the lager next to us, all with wired, electrical wires, so you couldn't go close to it, even though a mother and daughter saw each other from one camp to the other, and they one went and she got electrocuted. And then the Germans called us outside for us to see it so that we can this is a lesson for us. It's like when they, if you steal something, they would hang that person, and but everybody has to go and see the hanging. So we said the prayer, the Polish, yes, when did we say the prayer? Also because they light, they lit the candles for Shabbat. And, but then, you know, in the morning they would beat us, so we would say in Latino, in Spanish, estas son arroba pitas besa pizuza, which means they steal our bread because they gave us a portion of bread. You know what we did? We learned that very quickly. Because there, if you did not learn in 24 hours what was the organization of the camp, you were dead. You take the bread and you sleep over it, like a pillow. Because otherwise they will steal it from you. We did that with the pair of shoes that we had, also, as a pillow. Because they will steal it. They will come during the night and steal it. So what we said in Ladino and the Rabbi Nesim understood, aroma pitas, you steal pitas, right? And then you kiss the mezuzah. And all this got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and Magda, with a stick, we only slept 4 or 5 hours. You can imagine 5 people on each bunker, and with one blanket, one pulls it this way and one pulls it the other way. And sometimes we laugh. It's true. It's true. We did laugh. And we did sing. We did sing. We sang Italian songs. In fact, I even sang Italian songs for the Lager at the state with a cousin of mine. And I told my cousin Sarah, who was a very... in Auschwitz, the word is... the best word that you could learn and do it is organisier. Organisier means exactly that. You have to be very smart, very quick, very... if you have to steal, steal it, but quick, immediately. Don't look around. Do it and run. And that, so Sarah said, we are going to sing Italian songs, the Lager Elteste like Italian songs, so we went to sing, you know, Sorrento and all kinds of songs, and I used to tell her, I don't have any voice, sing, they don't understand anything, they don't understand Italian, so what, any word that comes up. But we came back with a lot of food because they had everything. If you went to see where the Lager Elteste, a Jewish woman, very very elegant, all dressed like thank you very much. Right. Black boots, black leather coat, very up to date, elegant, and. But in a way she was a good couple. She was a good couple because she knew after a month or so that 30 young women from Rhodes had died of natural death. They just died of fear, frightened, the water that was bad. And so the couple asked us, what other language do you speak besides Judeo-Spanish? We speak Greek, French. So immediately she went to the French barracks and she said, you are going to live with this group of people who also speak French. And so were the French and the Belgian women. And I must say that because of that, many of us were saved. I mean, I think I know that I owe my life to... Because, first of all, we made good friends immediately. And second of all, they told us all the little things to know. And to teach us few German words. How to read the number in German, because we don't have names anymore. They call you then, and you have to be there present immediately. And because otherwise Magda was there to... to be immediately with a stick. And the French were very, very good. very good for us. And also they told us after a month or 3 weeks we were there, don't expect to see your parents anymore. The smell of the smoke that you see every day in the crematoria, that's where they did go. And we thought, oh, they are saying that, absolutely. This is not possible, they cannot do that. I mean, this is Europe. Although it did not look Europe. It really did not look Europe. Poland, I don't know if any, no, here you are also studying. Poland must be a terrible, terrible country. I went, a month ago, I went to Auschwitz for the first time. I'm going to tell you a little more of that. But Auschwitz was a place like out of this world. It seemed to us like we arrived in a different planet altogether. It was flat, foggy. You've seen it in the movies, Schindler's List, with the big lights over it, and then you see that fog that comes. You couldn't see anything but ghosts in those striped pajamas, and I thought, where are we? What is this? Really, it seemed like out of this world. Did not seem real at all. And then, fortunately, the Russians were advancing towards Auschwitz, towards Poland, and sometimes we could even hear and the artillery. And in October, at the end of October 1944, yes. Oh, we did Tanit Yom Kippur. They knew. The Polish Jews, they knew everything. This is Rosh Chodesh, this is that. Today, Rosh Hashanah. And so, 8 days later, Yom Kippur. I said, well, it's not a difficult Yom Kippur. We are already starving here, so it's very easy. Very easy. The only thing was that in the bunks across from us, there was two sisters, Menashe from Rhodes. They started all day long. Now, what do you think our mothers would cook? What did you cook for Kurta Tanit, you know, for the end of Tanit, right? Oh, we used to make pipitada, and we say, stop that. And everybody was remembering the, you know, the dishes that we are making and so forth. But it was a way also to keep alive, because it was the only thing that was keeping our sanity, that we are still humans, remembering. That was the thing, memory of things past that were nice, that felt good. At the end of October, the Russians are coming, or rather approaching, and there is going to be a selection. That's one of the famous selections of the Germans. I cannot tell you that the doctor was Mengele. Probably was, but then we did not know any of the names of these people, because Mengele was the only one who was doing always the selections. Now we know, in reading the history of the camps. Again, naked, in front of the Germans, you are going to go through, and he's going to look at you. If you are okay to go to Germany, then you'll go. If you are not, you'll go to the gas chambers. Again, left, right, left, right. So we heard that, and we said, oh my God. What are we going to do? Do we look good? So my cousin Sarah, always very, very organized, she went to the kitchen, stole a piece of the beef, and she started putting on all our cheeks, so we look good. And so we went to the doctors up there, doctors, dogs, always with German shepherds. They don't walk along the SS, always with the German shepherd. And so we passed, and believe me, I did not want to turn around to see if my sister was coming or not, for the fear that they would have sent her on the other side. When we got through, the five of us, because there were always five in a row, and we got through into the showers again, take the showers, and now they are giving us a coat, a dress and a coat, but no, the shoes were terrible, no socks. And we went on the train, and a German guard told Madame Katz, was a Belgian woman, she spoke French and Yiddish and German, she told Madame Katz, who was like a mother for us, because she was the only one, 45, and we always called her Madame Katz. Her daughter also was there, was the only one that had mother and daughter in the same camp. So he told her, you are coming out of this camp, now you can hope to survive the war. Because Auschwitz was a death camp. It's an elimination camp. It wasn't a war camp. That was Auschwitz III, but that was a war camp, because there they worked for the farben industry and big German firms. But not Auschwitz-Birkenau. Auschwitz-Birkenau was built in 1942 or 43 for Jewish women. And that's where they had the 4 gas chambers and 5 crematoria. And you can imagine that when they destroyed one crematorio, that was not enough. In other words, they were gassing too many people and not enough time to burn them in the crematorium. Thousands every day, especially when the Hungarians came from Budapest. We went to Germany on the train for 2 days. We arrived in Landsberg, very nice, the climate was beautiful. The snow was there for the first time. I saw snow in my life. In Rhodes, definitely, you never see snow, you see the sun, maybe 9 months out of the year, but never the snow. And small camp, working camp. So I work in the kitchen, then I work in cleaning the barracks of the Germans. And those were good jobs, because first of all, you were inside. And second of all, you could eat whatever you could eat inside the kitchen, but if you steal, you are hanged and you are caught. Then we did a few other camps. They always transfer from one camp to the other. Then we went to Turkheim, where the KAKOs, there were a men's camp and a women's camp. The KAKOs of the men's camp were from Salonika. And they also had become very hardened by being there since 1943. They were very very cruel to the men. To us, they were good. And that was in Turkheim. Then we went to another camp, and we finally, the Allies are coming, and you could hear the airplanes coming to Munich every day. The sky was almost covered by American airplanes. And we could hear also the bombs and the noises, and, because Munich was very close to where we were. And then for 3 days and 4 nights, we walked and walked under the rain and walked. And we arrived in a camp near Dachau, about 2 kilometers outside Dachau, because there was no room anymore in Dachau to get them all in, because they were all. In the meantime, we could see that the Germans were fleeing. They were dumping their weapons, and so we arrived in that camp. We go into barracks again, and the day after, there are no Germans. They had left. And a few hours later, the American came. And that was 1945, 59 years ago. April, at the end of April, 1st of May. Any questions? Yes. In fact, I wanted to continue. Yes, that's right. That's true. In fact, we asked all, you know, we were all asking where shall we go, and my sister and other friends, we decided we'll go to Italy. Because if nothing else, if we have to go to Rhodes, at least Italy is closer, and we have Italian passports. Well, the passports did not exist anymore, right? But we are Italian citizens. We speak the language. And I had some friends also in Italy, so we went to Italy. Like also her father went to Italy. Why? I don't know. I had more friends than Pepo has on, but... Oh, the Americans take you there. Sure. A black guy, right. And we are singing, and he's singing with us. He's singing the American songs, we are singing Italian songs. All singing. But one thing that I must say, what is the human being? When we crossed Munich, Munich was already completely destroyed. I never saw a city that was so bombed. And we saw that some Germans were already coming in, getting in their homes, coming back to their city, with children, with bundles. Well, to see that kind of desperation in their faces, we started to cry. Just to look at them. Well, it was a good thing anyway. It was a good realization because we did not lose our humanity. It was very sad to see a city so completely destroyed and all these people are coming back and not finding anything. It was really tabula rasa. Munich was very like Dresden, and not that I have any sympathy, but you know, it's... Yes, we went to Italy, but we did not want to go back to Rhodes.
You never went back?
Oh yes, I did after, but it took me a few years. It was, in fact, when I went, I fainted. I go now every year, and still I see ghosts. I see ghosts. The ghosts of everyone. We were 1,900 people, 1,800 and so, 1,900 between Rhodes and Kos, the island of Kos, only 100 from there. 161 came back. It's 90%. The percentage this of Salonique, of the Cetadin in general, Salonique, Rhodes, Larissa, even considering the Romaniotes of Janina, higher than the Polish Jews. In Poland, the Polish Jews, 89%, we had 90% of the Sephardim that went into the camp, 90% died. As Rabbi Nesin was saying, that there were 65,000 Jews in Salonique then. It was the biggest, largest Sephardic city. Then 54 went to the camp. Now, and 45,000 died. When they came back, they all went to Israel. Especially some of them waited until Israel became a state, and then they went, and some of them went to also to fight as volunteers. There is only 1,000 people in Salonika now, 1,000 Jews in Salonika. But they have now a Jewish museum that is absolutely a jewel. There is one in Athens that is very beautiful, but the one in Salonika is it's really very, very touching and very beautiful, because it goes back also to, you know, there were the Greek-speaking Jews there before the Sephardim arrived.
Can you tell us about your visit now to Auschwitz?
Yes. the chair of Jewish studies at the Sorbonne is Vidal Chaim Vidal Sepicha, Professor Sepicha, who also is a survivor of Auschwitz. He was born in Belgium, but his parents came from Turkey. And so he was taken, also his mother, father, and another brother. in the year 2000, he went to Salonika because there was a convention of what's going to happen to the Sephardic language, to Ladino, and so forth. And there, it came to him, and then after that, he went to Auschwitz on the March of the Living with a lot of people from Salonika. When they went there, they saw plaques with writing, you know, in every language but Judeo-Spanish. Immediately came to him, he says, no, I have to do something. Went back to Paris, where he lives, and called another Sephardi, Michel Azaria, who is a very famous person and knows a lot of people in the government, and they started to this campaign to have a plaque in Judeo-Spanish. So finally, they accepted. A lot of money was given by the French government. If you want to know, $100,000 they gave. Yeah. From America, nothing. $1,000 only. And he approached us, one of the guys approached ASF, and Vivian did not want to, I don't know, to participate for some reason. Anyway, but it doesn't matter. We got the plaque. And then it was announced in, we have a group, a Yahoo group, we only write in Ladino, only. Not Spanish, Castilian, modern, or anything. Has to be Ladino. And Ladino with the orthography of the Aki Yerushalayim, which is a magazine. Do you know the Aki Yerushalayim? And I'll send you the new copy. We just got it. And Moshe Shaul is the editor of that magazine, and it's written strictly in Ladino. So it was announced that March 24 there is going to be the unveiling of that plaque. I immediately decided, it was already for many years I've been thinking I'm going to go, but I never had the courage. And last year I said, if I want to go, I will go by train from Athens to Auschwitz, because I want to do the same route again. And but it wasn't to be. So about four or five people from America, from the States, they joined me here at the airport. We met there, one from Dallas, two people from Washington, and one from New Jersey. And we went there, but there it was all very well. We went to Krakow. Very well organized by the French, the group of the French Jews. And there were a lot of people that came from Israel, 22 people from Turkey, from Istanbul. And we had the American consul of Krakow, we had the French consul of Krakow, and then a few other personalities. They all, you know, the speeches and all this. Well, my impression of Auschwitz as I arrived, it was, oh, they brought it from Krakow in buses, right? And the parking lot was already full of buses. It was like going to Walt Disney, Disneyland. All the buses and everybody coming out, or we are going to go and see the Parthenon or any of the other, well, those are antiquities. This one is not very antiquity. My whole impression, it was too abstract, because I did not expect to see a museum. If you haven't lived that, you don't know what it is. The best writers of the Holocaust, Primo Levi, no relation to me, I wish. I met him. And Elie Wiesel, but Primo Levi much more so, because if you read Italian, you know how his books are really incredible. Still, there are no adequate words to describe what it was. So you see, you know, vitrines full of little shoes of the infants and all this. I wanted to imagine my little cousin, Pepo Funio. But the other people, did they, what kind of feelings did they have, you know? And you see vitrines full of hair and all that. And then you go outside, gift shop. I said, gift shop? They sell books. All right. or maybe postcards. What else could they sell? But then in going into Birkenau, we had a guy, the Polish young woman, who was very nice. When she heard that I was a survivor, she said, "You tell them. You tell them what you live here." And we entered the barracks, and especially, I don't know if you know the word, latrines, which were, I don't want even to mention it to your two, this is the group of people to mention that. I would say I don't wish it on my enemies, if I have any, the horrors that we have lived. Any other questions? Then I came to America, she wants to
have you survived something like this? What do you do? Where is the like I said, it's all around.
We came into Italy, what do? You immediately go to a Jewish community. Very simple. First of all, we arrived in Bolzano. My sister, I, Lucia, those were the first refugees. My sister, yes. Yes. Oh yes, I said at the beginning that was another, yes. Now my sister, we had also little, you know, there were so many little incidents of every day, you know, that with my sister, once they took her number to transfer her into another camp, and I had to go and beg with Madame Katz, who spoke German, and beg. I went on my knees in front of the SS woman, who was the guard of the camp. I went on my knees to ask, and she was very good, and her name was Erika, a German woman, and she asked the number, because that's the name we had, and she went to the office and erased my sister's name and put another number, and put another number. And so my sister, you know, we always wanted to be together. How do you survive? Not very well, because you live with the nightmares, and you live with, for a long time, you smell death. But, and I must say that the women survived better than men, much better. Much better, and in numbers also, more so. We only had from Rhodes, 20 men and 140 women survived.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did
anyone
go back to Rhodes? Yes, I do. Okay. Is there any survivors? Is there a community
there now? Oh, there is a community, no, but not of the survivors. Only even Sami Modiano, who goes there, he goes in the summer. There are only 32 Jews there. We wanted at the beginning, I'm sorry, can you hear me? At the beginning, the Jews from Rhodes that lived here in the States wanted to start a community again, and they thought what they always did, you know, bring some people from the mainland Greece, from Salonika, from Volos, in fact, one family is from Volos, the Cohens, and they gave them, you know, businesses, homes to live in, and so forth. There are only 32. It's a pity, but we go, some of the survivors, we go every summer, because now we have a project of the restoration of the synagogue and the cemetery, and we are trying to also build a little museum. In the Judaea, before the war, we were almost 5,000.
And what did it consist of?
All Jews.
Businesses.
All businesses, yes, businesses. And if there were any widows or poor people, always taken care of by the community.
Okay.
We never asked a penny from the outside. Always the community took care of it. The packages for Pesach, oil, you know, bottles of oils, eggs, the matzos, everything, all we prepared it in, I mean, not I, because I was a little girl, but I remember that's how people lived. We always did help each other. There was no problem. And we had a Jewish center like this one, and I am also very proud to say that it's a great uncle of mine who built it and gave it to the community. And with the name Novrika, maybe you must have heard. Yeah. Yes, sure. Oh. From where? Ah, yeah.
So
there are no words, no words. Very, we find poor words. I tried many times to. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Okay.
I know it's very difficult.
You have to start speaking our. Day and night is not enough.
Yes. But I am very grateful that they all came and that you are listening, because now I feel for many years we did not talk about it.
Zahor.
Yes, that's right. I have to remember. To remember. Thank you very, very much.
I have a question. When did you come here?
I was one of the first refugees that came here in 1948. Yes.
Very good.
I've read a lot about people like you, and truly, truly an amazing personality. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. The estimate, just to give you some idea, some numbers of the Sephardim that perished during the Holocaust. The truth is that according to most historians, they have a lot of difficulty with the number. They claim somewhere around maybe 200,000, maybe around 150,000 Sephardim perished during the Holocaust. It's a number that doesn't sound so big next to the number of how many people perished, but when you think of the number, it's a great number. Before the war, according to the estimates, there was about 1,300,000 Sephardim in the world, and so about 200,000 disappeared, perished during the war. Another estimate that we were informed about is that before the war, there was maybe some 300,000 of these Sephardim spoke Judeo-Espanol, and since this was the area that was most affected, maybe under 100,000 of them only spoke the Judeo-Espanol after the war. So two-thirds of the Judeo-speaking Sephardim perished during the war, and some of the historians claim that unfortunately this is one of the reasons why the language declined even more and unfortunately has not disappeared today. We would like to say Ashkava for just to end the program. Please stand your eyes. Selmale Rahamim, Shokenva Meromim, Anseme Nuhane, Kona, Alkanfesh, Hinaba Malot, Kedoshima Tehorim, Kesor Harakia Madrim, Et Neshamot, Hakedoshima Tehorim, Shinehergu, Alkidush Hashem, בגנד אין תאמן וחתם, לכן בעל הרחמים יסירים בסתר כנפיו לעולמים, ויצור ויצור החיים את נשמותיהם, אדוני נחלתם וינוחו בשלום על משכבותם וכן ירצון ונאמר אמן. Thank you very much.